It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, teacher licensing rules have been loosened to address a teacher shortage in Wisconsin. We'll get the latest as back-to-school time gets closer and closer. First, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen signaled today that a change to the nation's low interest rates could be on the way. In a speech at a policy conference earlier today, Yellen said the case for raising the interest rate has strengthened in recent months due to improving economic conditions. She stopped short, though, of saying when that raise might actually happen. The Fed raised its benchmark interest rate in December, the first hike in nearly a decade, but it's still sitting at this historically low 0.4%. So why has that rate been almost untouchable for so long, and what does it all mean for you? Chris Farrell joins us now. He's a senior economics contributor for Marketplace and economics commentator for Minnesota Public Radio. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the thing all this time in this interest rate has been, okay, the economy's improving, but not fast, so we don't want to raise the interest rate, risk that recovery. Are we getting to a point where we're saying, okay, things are good enough, we can bump that rate up?
Well, there's a large group of people who are saying, well, what's really changed? Yes, she's given this talk before where she's saying there's signs of strengthening the economy, and there's no question about that when you look at the decline in the unemployment rate. And recently we got some numbers that, you know, the housing market is doing better, and earlier in the week we got the durable goods number. These are the, you know, refrigerators and, you know, automobiles, longer-term investments. And, you know, that was doing better, largely driven by commercial aircraft, but still doing better. So there's lots of signs that the economy is doing all right. But there's, and Yellen's been saying, as the economy gets better, we're going to raise this benchmark interest rate. But the betting is they're not going to do it in September. Maybe they'll do it in December. But again, there's no inflation problem. There's still a lot of people out of the labor force that would like to be in the labor force. What's the rush? So this talk didn't really change anything except for reiterate her position. We will be raising that benchmark interest rate as we get signs of strength in the economy.
You mentioned inflation. Is that one of the downsides of keeping rates low, the potential downsides, I should say, of keeping these rates low, that inflation might go up?
Well, you know, they'd actually like to see a little bit of inflation because they have this target range of 2%, and inflation's running around, you know, 1.5%, 1.2%. It really hasn't, for the past 5-6 years, hasn't really gotten very close to 2%. And, you know, part of this, this is part of the debate that's going on, is this because we just don't have enough, we're just not growing fast enough. You know, if we had some faster growth, we'd have higher inflation rates, or are we in a global economy with Amazon.com and the U.S. being the swing producer now with oil, with the shale oil revolution? And so in this world, instead of a price pressure toward inflation or higher prices, is it really a price pressure toward deflation or lower prices? This is one of the big questions that's out there. No one has a really good answer. There's a lot of good answers, but no one has the answer on that. But that is one of the things that people are saying, look, you don't have inflation, you still have a lot of people looking for jobs, why rush it?
Yeah, so why rush it? If there doesn't seem to be a downside, why does it just seem like it's something we got to do at some point?
Well, it's this thing, what it seems to be, and I think what it has become, whether you're on Wall Street or you're in Washington, D.C., you know, it has become sort of, it is the symbol of a return to normalcy. That seems to be why this is, there's so much interest in this, why it seems to be so important. And, you know, they've signaled fairly strongly over the past year, as you mentioned, that they might raise this benchmark interest rate. And then if you remember, there were the concerns about China. Was the Chinese economy imploding? And what were the spillover effects there? Maybe we shouldn't do it now. So there's been lots of things that have been happening that have slowed the hand of the Federal Reserve. So this has become a sign that the Federal Reserve is really confident about the economic recovery. They're really confident we're going back to a normal world, and that seems to be reassuring to Wall Street. So that's why she wants to do it. But again, you keep coming back to this job market's not as healthy as we'd like it to be, despite this low unemployment rate.
It seems like raising the interest rate is kind of like cleaning the basement. You have the notion that you should do it sometime, but there's always a good reason to not do it right now. So that said, are we going to find a reason to not do it in September and not do it in December?
So the betting is definitely September's out. Moody's economy.com came out with like a 30% chance of raising in September. That seems to be kind of a consensus point of view. Much higher possibility in December if we get a good fall, if we get some higher numbers. So December is a real possibility. And that's where I think the betting right now is going on. But I do want to emphasize one of the really important parts of her speech. You know, we're all looking at what are they going to do with this benchmark interest rate. But, you know, over the past couple of years, the Federal Reserve has done all these unusual things, negative yield, you know, negative interest rates, quantitative easing. And what she said, and I think this is really important, that in the world we're moving into, these are probably going to become standard parts of the Federal Reserve's toolkit, that quantitative easing is not a one-time event. Negative yields might not be a one-time event, that we may be moving into the kind of economy where the Fed is going to have to use these tools more often than not, rather than just simply being a side effect of the 2008-2009 Great Recession and global credit crunch.
We're talking to Chris Farrell from Marketplace about Janet Yellen, Fed Reserve Chair's speech today, looking at interest rates and, as he was just saying, so much more. I want to talk about this from an individual consumer perspective here, Chris. One, we had a caller actually kind of wondering about this. With these low interest rates, do we as individuals want to invest in the stock market? Do we want to save money, given that we get no return with low interest rates? And on the other hand, if rates are going up, should people be thinking about maybe doing that mortgage refinance they were kicking around?
Sure, a couple of things. First of all, one of the reasons why they want to return this world of normalcy and raise that interest rate is just because so many people are trying to save, and it is really hard to save when you don't get any interest rates, right? I mean, you probably have opened up your bank statement and you look at it and you made, you know, 3 cents over the past couple of years off the interest on your savings account. And lots of people have that. Yes, we're talking about raising interest rates, but it is doubtful that the spillover effect is going to be huge in terms of the mortgage market. So I would just be asking myself, should you be refinancing? Does it make financial sense for you to do it? Go ahead. But if interest rates are going to go up, when the Fed makes its move, let's say it's December, if the Fed makes its move in December, there will be some ripple effects, but we're not going back to a world of 6% interest rates or 8% interest rates. You know, you're talking about a modest increase working its way through the mortgage market.
The core issue, Chris, seems to be, as you indicated earlier, well, how is the economy doing really? And everybody's been talking about, yeah, it's a recovery, but it's a slow recovery. Jobs aren't where we want them. But then compare that to some of the times the economy's been looking great, but it turns out it was built on a bubble, dot-coms or right. Overinflated housing prices fueled by way too much debt. So is this gradual economy not as good as we want to see, but built on a stronger foundation?
I think it is built on a stronger foundation. You know, the one area that they're worried about with the low interest rates is the commercial real estate market, because developers tend to borrow huge sums of money. And at a low interest rate, there's always that temptation to borrow too much. But overall, this is a slow, steady economy. It's built on a good foundation. My suspicion is if you look at this economy, everything's kind of been slow in terms of, you know, the unemployment rate dropping. Now I think we're going to see the labor force participation rate is going to increase. So it's a very healthy economy. When you look at the private sector, a lot of the job losses have actually been in state and local governments and not much growth in the federal government. And we're starting to see some pickup there. So my suspicion is slow and steady, and we're always going to be surprised when it kicks into a higher gear.
Hey, Chris, there's this story out there we've been kind of following here on Central Time, this presidential race thing.
Oh, that thing?
You know,
yeah.
I don't know if you've been tracking that. So people wonder, the Federal Reserve, are they going to increase rates? Are they going to do something funky as we head toward a presidential election? Or are they going to wait till after? Ideally, the theory is they're insulated from politics. Are they really?
No, well, yes and no. Are they going to do something to try and affect the presidential election? No, they're not going to do that. I mean, they're looking at the economic data. They have their own credibility to worry about. And if you think about institutions like the Federal Reserve really do worry about their credibility and not the credibility of the President of the United States. So what they'll be looking at is they'll be doing two things. One is looking at the economic data, making this judgment call. When do we proclaim at the top of our lungs that we're moving back to this normal? normal world. They'll also be looking at, depending on how the presidential election goes, are there risks out there that if you look at, for example, Brexit in England, the central bank eased dramatically when the Brexit vote went through as an insurance policy to try and prevent, and it looks like successful, to help prevent a potential recession. So you could get that kind of reaction. I don't think we'd actually would have that, but you might get that kind of reaction from the Federal Reserve, but I don't believe the Federal Reserve will at all try to manipulate the election.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Been talking to Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace and economics commentator for Minnesota Public Radio. He joined us to talk about a possible upcoming interest rate hike from the Federal Reserve. Big speech today from the Federal Reserve Chair, Janet Yellen. Right now, State School Superintendent Tony Evers announced a plan this week to make it easier for teachers at the beginning and at the end of their careers to be licensed to teach in Wisconsin. Department of Public Instruction officials say this is aimed at addressing a teacher shortage in some districts around the state. Molly Beck joins us now with the details. She's a Capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with the basics, Molly. What kind of changes is DPI talking about here?
Sure. The biggest changes would be a relaxing of the requirements that teachers who are teaching on a one-year emergency teaching license to renew that. So these changes would allow those teachers to renew for a second year, even if they haven't passed the required tests that they're supposed to be taking to make that one-year license permanent. And it would also allow retired teachers or teachers planning to retire to get a non-renewable five-year teaching license without going through professional development, which is training that's required to get such licenses. So the Department of Public Instruction and the officials there have said that this is to address what they're, you know, anticipating is going to be a significant shortage of teachers in the schools in Wisconsin.
And let's look at that teacher shortage for a bit. As I understand it, you write that DPI isn't really tracking, they're not doing a census of how many teachers are out there as they used to, but they still have some indicators are showing a likely shortage?
Sure, yeah. Up until 2008, they had been creating these reports called supply and demand reports, which, you know, looked at how many teachers every school district needed and how many were available, you know, looking at a variety of measures, including how many students were in teacher preparation programs in colleges and universities. They stopped doing that in 2008, but they still monitored all of that information through things that the federal government requires them to track. And through the emergency license process that I talked about earlier, how many teachers were getting these emergency licenses, which teachers get when school districts need a teacher and can't find one.
And Molly, kids are starting to go back to school next week in a lot of places, right after Labor Day and some others. Are these changes, they're taking effect, you know, now as kids are heading back to school?
Yeah, they're in effect now. That's right.
So from what you hear from DPI, does this mean that school districts out there are headed into the school year and saying, We're short teachers, and we're opening the doors in just a few days?
Sure. I know that for a couple of years, school districts have been really worried about the technical education area. There are very few places in Wisconsin that students who want to teach that subject can study that and become the technical teachers. So They've been anticipating a shortage in that area, and I think overall, you know, school districts are seeing that there are just fewer students in these teacher preparation programs overall, and that's a nationwide trend too. That's not just specific to Wisconsin. So, you know, I talked to DPI officials, and they're saying it's just getting to a point that, you know, they know they have to do something, and they can't just, you know, wait for you know, students to decide that they want to go into teaching. You know, there are just reasons right now that students aren't going into those programs like they used to.
I'll dig into that a little more in a bit. But looking at what we're hearing from the DPI now, I understand there are also changes for substitute teachers and how long they can be appointed, I guess, in a certain slot.
Sure. Right. Yeah. There's, you know, when you when a teacher is on leave, if, you know, it's a female teacher and she becomes pregnant or things like that, and you need a substitute teacher that is there for longer than just a day or two, the short-term substitute teachers can stay in the same teaching assignment for up to 45 days. And that's a new change from 20 days.
Now, to clarify one thing that the new rules are not, a while back an idea was floated in Wisconsin of alternative teacher licensing, mm-hmm. things like, okay, no, you don't need a teacher certification license. If you have work experience in whatever the particular subject is, you can get a different kind of license. That is not what's on the table now.
Right. No, that's not what's on the table. I know that in the last budget, Governor Walker signed a budget that would require DPI to grant an initial teaching license to teach technical education subjects to address that shortage that I talked about before, and also grant an initial teaching license to any person that was licensed in another state and had taught for at least a year in that state. So that kind of relaxed the requirements a little bit too in grades 6 through 12. But this does not allow just anybody with work experience to come in and teach that subject that they have the experience in, that, like what was proposed earlier.
Talking to Molly Beck from the Wisconsin State Journal about new offerings from the State Department of Public Instruction on the eve of a new school year, allowing teachers either very early in their career, at the end of their career, retired, making it easier for them to get licensed as teachers. And Molly, let's look at the deeper causes behind this problem. You wrote mm-hmm. about a concern that the pipeline, the usual plan, people go into education, they go through college, they get their teacher certification. Here in Wisconsin, that is producing fewer teachers than it used to. What were some of the theories or explanations that people were talking about?
Sure. I talked to Dan Rossmiller at the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, and he said that the pipeline is becoming narrower and weaker, the words that he used. And he said that, you know, it's kind of anecdotal evidence, but there, since the recession of 2008, school districts, I think at that time, weren't able to give the kind of raises that maybe they had in previous years, which you kind of struck a blow to the reliability of teacher pay, so to speak. And that perception of maybe, you know, the teaching profession is not this job I can go into and know can count on, you know, this salary and I'll make a cost of living increase, because some districts weren't even able to do that. So, you know, the status of teachers, he said, is not being seen as high as it once was. And he thinks that's probably one reason that there are fewer people going into the profession. You talk to, you know, a lot of, if you talk to, public school advocates and teacher union representatives, you know, they'll say that, Act 10, Governor Walker's collective bargaining measure, that eliminated teacher union contracts may be contributing to fewer people going into teacher preparation programs in Wisconsin. And then that's obviously disputed from Republicans in Governor Walker's office, obviously. But there's a whole lot of reasons that people are floating around why there might be fewer people going into teaching.
And with the technological education field mm-hmm. that you mentioned, we're seeing particular shortages in. You write, in effect, school districts are raiding teachers from other districts?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I when I looked at how school districts, a few years ago, I was looking at how school districts were, you know, going to address not having teacher union contracts. And one thing I noticed was, you know, in these hard-to-fill subject areas like tech ed, they're, you know, districts who have the money, they're going to pay these teachers more to attract them to their school district, because these are also subject areas that are pretty important in 2016, tech ed would be. And because there's also so few programs to study to become that kind of teacher in Wisconsin, there's very few teachers. So districts who have the money to do it, they're going to pay them more, they're going to give them bonuses, they're going to offer to pay for their moving expenses. And obviously districts who don't have the money to do that can't, you know, lure away a teacher from another district. So that's kind of the dynamic that that I think school districts are kind of worried about right now.
And Molly, briefly switching gears in our last couple of minutes, news out this week on ACT scores in Wisconsin. Headlines looked bad on first reading. We'd gone down below the national average after a lot of years on near the top of the pack on ACT scores, these annual tests. But we're doing it differently now. Everybody, as I understand it, in a certain grade is taking the test where it used to be selected students. Can you talk about that?
Right. Yeah. This is the first time that 100% of the, you know, the students in their junior year were taking the ACT test. And that's hard to compare this year's scores to previous years because only, I think, 70% or so were taking it in previous years. But it is significant that now that, you know, everybody's taking it and we're looking at what those scores are, they're below the national average. So I think that's why you saw the headlines that you did, that it's something that, you know, education officials are looking at. But, you know, the state superintendent said that drop in the average score was anticipated, and it's a decent place to start for school districts.
So we're starting kind of in a whole new era of how we evaluate the whole ACT test.
Right.
Well, Molly, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Molly Beck. She's a Capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us to talk about changes in how Wisconsin teachers are licensed, new announcements from the State Department of Public Instruction on the eve of a new school year. We also touched on a change in the way we administer the ACT test to high school students in Wisconsin and how that's changing Wisconsin's national ranking. It's time for Food Friday. We all want our food to taste good, no question there. But there's an old saying, first you eat with your eyes. And it often rings true. Food that looks better often tastes kind of better. But presenting a dish is more than just plopping some food on a plate the way I do it. There's a certain art that goes along with it as well. Our next guest is a Wisconsin chef who has some tricks up his sleeve to bring our food presentation skills to the next level. He'll also share some recipes that can fancy up your next mealtime. Brian Frakes joins us now. He's executive chef at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So food, Brian, can be really, you know, utilitarian. It's a thing we need to eat to survive. Give us the case. Get us inspired to make our food look good and fun and enjoyable.
Well, I think your flopping method gets you fed, but probably isn't as artsy-fartsy as what you're looking for. You know, I'm kind of a naturally creative guy, but you don't necessarily need to be. There's a lot of little tricks, and, you know, we do a program here called Food Art, where we kind of walk guests through it. But, yeah, I have lots of little tricks. I think, you know, seasonal food is sexy, local food is sexy. A lot of times less is more. Fresh herbs are always a big help. A lot of people leave that part out. Seasoning food properly, adding texture to your dish.
Yeah, so when I'm serving something up, I don't do this as much anymore. My style of cooking I call glop style. You know, beans that you put on rice, or lentils that you put on rice, or, you know, just blobs of food. If I'm serving a dish like that, what are some easy ways that I can jazz it up, plate it, and make it look nicer?
As opposed to glopping, you know, if you're doing rice and beans, you know, one trick is just go in your kitchen and maybe grab the wrong dish on purpose and see what happens. But I think oversized plates can help if you're entertaining friends and leave some negative space. So you would just do a nice little circle of your rice in the middle and a circle of beans on top of that. There's probably some liquid from cooking the beans. Put that in a separate pan. Reduce it down a little bit with some butter, and then drizzle that around the side. A little bit of chopped fresh herbs over the top, and I think you'll like what you got.
How about garnishing? I mean, we've all seen the little sprig of parsley on the restaurant plate. I assume we can get more creative with garnish than that.
Sure. Well, a lot of times, what's in the dish is always going to be your best garnish. Just recent, you know, we're coming into apple season, did a dish here where it was really about apples and duck, but we cooked the apples five different ways. We sliced them thin and marinated them. We baked some. We grilled some. We made a donut fritter out of it. You know, you don't need to do all that, but if you what you have in your dish, if you play with it two or three different ways, that presents itself well, and it adds the nice texture. As far as it, you know, what I have here at the Pfister, I'm sitting on $100,000 worth of inventory, but you don't need all the fancy microgreens. And you know, you go to a nice restaurant and you pay an extra $20 for someone to put a green you don't recognize on there because it's colorful. You have some of these in your house. Chances are, if you go into your stock of celery, there's those beautiful light celery leaves in the middle. You pick those out and season them with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper, and that's a beautiful little garnish. Well, so those are a couple of tips of mine.
Well, hearing your thing about using apples different ways, that just made me think, if I'm making a dish, I cook with carrots and things a lot, a stir fry or
sure.
soup or whatever. Maybe just
sure.
take one carrot aside, grate it raw, and then sprinkle that on the top or on the side.
Bingo. Or roast it, and then the ends of the carrot, throw it in a pan, dump a half a Pepsi Cola in there and reduce it down, puree it, and you're gonna have a nice sweet sauce. You can make it a little more savory with black pepper and Worcestershire, and you know, it looks like a demi-glace that you get in a fancy restaurant. So yeah, it's just, you know, think about the things you throw away. Obviously in my business, that's our job, is to utilize as much of the product as we can, so that has lent us some tricks along the way that we just found out by accident, but it works at home too. As I'm managing my inventory here, everybody is at home as well. You want to get the most out of your refrigerator, so it can be a win-win if you just think outside of the box a little bit.
I'm talking to Brian Frakes, executive chef at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee, talking about making our food look as good as, if not better than, it tastes. And you mentioned just coming up with that quick sauce to put on. And Brian, I got to say, when I'm at a fancy or even fancy-ish restaurant, that is always impressive, the cool-looking sauce either right on the thing or drizzled kind of artfully on the plate. And my assumption is that's really, this is a fancy reduction sauce that the sous chef or whatever you call them took hours to create. It's not that hard to do?
Well,
maybe
it is. I mean, if it's done properly, and how our saucier does it here, it is.
Saucier, that's the one.
But you can make mock versions very quickly. I do it at home, and from time to time we'll do it here as well. So yeah, it's one word. It's reduce. If you just take apple cider and start reducing that, it's going to become more syrupy. I always like to finish with a little bit of whole butter because that just adds a nice smooth richness to it. But seriously, take some apple cider, reduce it by half, and drizzle that around the outside of your plate with duck or chicken or right on top of the chicken. Throw some fresh herbs in there at the last minute, and you have this beautiful, vibrant sauce. You could reduce tomato juice. Same deal. Reduction is a huge thing, and we always have pots simmering here 24 hours a day, doing it the old-fashioned way. But in your kitchen, there's something in there you can reduce right now. Orange juice, pineapple juice.
You know, Brian, I enjoy cooking. I find it fun. But this sounds like it's tapping into a whole nother creative part of our mind. Does this make cooking more fun, whether at work or at home for you?
Absolutely. Everybody's got their phones out, and that was kind of the genesis of this food art thing. Is myself, all my friends are pretty much chefs, and we're on social media posting what we're doing pretty regularly, and I think everybody wants to post. If they go to a nice restaurant, they take their phones out and take pictures of it because we're impressed by it. And like you say, it's an old cliche that we eat with our eyes, but it still holds true.
And teaching this food art class, first of all, is that fun for you, getting out from the kitchen and working with some of the consumers?
Oh, it's awesome. It's that opportunity to interact with our guests or local VIPs, and it's fun for them to interact. Everybody wants to get to know the chef a little bit better and spend some time with him. So me and my team, we enjoy it greatly because we get to show off a little bit and raise some eyebrows when people realize that it's once you think about things a little bit different way, it's not that hard.
I want to. You sent us some recipes. We put a couple of them up at the Central Time Facebook page. We've got one that has apples, squash, duck breast, and more. Again, this is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. But, Brian, can you describe this? Walk us through this one a little bit.
Oh, geez, I wish I was looking at it. But I believe it's a Sonoma duck breast. It's got an apple fritter on. So this was inspired by Weston's Apples in New Berlin. Again, local and seasonal. Seasonal is sexy, and this place is awesome. Just has these wonderful apples. We went out, hand-picked them, and came back and created a dish. I believe, if I recall correctly, so going back to sauces, I cooked off some apples, reduced them down with a chicken stock, and just a little plating trick, rather than just drizzling, lay it down on a plate, and then you take a bowl. We use circle cutters and have other fancy tools, but at home, if you say you take a syrupy reduction, work the rim of the bowl around onto that plate, and then place that bowl upside down onto the plate that you're plating on, you get a perfect ring. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you get
Did
you make a
right?
shape in the syrup. I get it. Yeah.
So it's a perfect circle. You just mm-hmm. use something that shape and turn it upside down onto the plate, and boom, it looks like you're some sort of artist. That is an apple dish five ways with a beautiful duck breast on there, some goat cheese, some drunken figs. So we took some dried figs, reduced them down in wine, a little bit of honey in there, and boom, beautiful. We did pumpernickel gaufrettes. So that's a real fancy term for croutons. So again, even with croutons, it doesn't need to be this cube that, you know, breaks your jaw a little bit. You could slice your bread super thin, so it has a nice light texture, and just lightly bake that off in the oven and just kind of rethink everything. Think about it a different way, and really that's all that chefs do.
It is Food Friday, and we're talking about the art of food presentation, from plating to garnish, everything in between. Our guest is Brian Frakes, executive chef at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee, helping us have some fun and creativity on how we lay out that food. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Brian about how to jazz up maybe what you're planning to cook tonight or over the weekend? And do you, when you're cooking at home or cooking for friends, do you plate it? Do you have fun? Do you make it look good when you're serving it up? And do you need some advice, or do you have some suggestions on how you do it at home? Keep it easy for my sake. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a couple recipes from Brian Frakes up there. It's Food Friday, and we're talking with Pfister Hotel executive chef Brian Frakes about the art of food presentation. They say we eat with our eyes, at least to start with. So with that in mind, we're talking about taking our food presentation skills to the next level. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you do at home to make your dishes look extra good? Do you think it's important that food have that strong visual appeal? And what questions do you have for Brian about jazzing up your own food presentation? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We have Tim on the line in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. Quick question for you. I grew up in a very strong Italian household. We did a lot of rustic Italian food. I like the idea of dressing up the food I do. The only issues are I'm not really big with sweet in my savory, and I'm not really big on balsamic vinegar.
So you're looking for ideas for more of a savory reduction, Tim?
Savory reduction kind of way.
Okay, Tim, thanks for that call. Brian, what do you suggest Tim do for a savory, non-balsamic vinegar reduction?
This is in reference to, say, a veal chop or chicken.
Tim, what are you thinking, a chicken dish or a beef dish?
Well, quite often I do, one of my favorite recipes is I'll do a grilled chicken with, wilted basil leaves over the top.
Yum.
Maybe with a really rugged kind of tomato sauce on the side with, noodles or rice or something with that. that effect.
All right, Brian, where do you go with that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, seriously, the old-fashioned way really isn't that hard. You go get some bones of whatever you're looking to do, whether it's chicken bones, beef bones, veal bones. You roast them off, throw a little of whatever vegetable you got in the fridge, really it should be carrot, onion, celery, and some cold water, and you just let that reduce. It's going to, you know, it depends on the bone you're using, but anywhere from 2 to 6 to 24 hours. But once you put that on low, it takes care of itself. That said, if that sounds too difficult, then it doesn't sound like it is for this gentleman. There's some great stocks out there and some really simple thickening methods, just a simple cornstarch slurry. Again, you go get some beef broth. Get that reducing down a little bit, pull some to the side and make a little slurry with cornstarch and that stock, and let that simmer and reduce, and I think you'll like what you end up with, and there's no sweetness to it.
Hope that helps, Tim. Brian, is that something I could do in a slow cooker? That, you know, with the bones and just keeping it on low for a long period of time?
No, because you want the moisture to escape.
Oh, okay. Oh, right. Obviously, otherwise it's not going to reduce. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Science 101 for Rob. Tim, thanks for the call. We'll go back to our callers now with Dee on the line in Madison. Dee, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in about an assisted living place that totally follows that philosophically. And my mom is in an assisted living place called Camomile on the east side of Madison, and they just designed their food beautifully. So today at lunch they had a spinach leaf, a slice of orange, a little sprig of parsley. Another time they had a leaf of kale. So you had the crinkly kale, then a smooth beet, and then a little bit of parsley, and then a little tiny dollop of sour cream. And the owner said it's cut down on food waste tremendously, that people visually are excited by this food.
Dee, I love that. Thank you so much. So in that institutional setting, Brian, and I've eaten in institutions, you know, church basements or dorms,
sure,
or hospitals,
and
I'll say visual appeal was not always the first thing they were going
for. No, that's not your typical potluck.
But that actually, it gets people to enjoy and eat their food more, she's saying.
Absolutely. I think that sounds wonderful. Maybe me and you should head there for lunch.
That sounds great. Tell your mom we'll drop by, Dee. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. As we talk to Brian Frakes, executive chef at Milwaukee's Pfister Hotel, we're talking about food presentation, making the food look as good as it tastes. Call in with your questions or suggestions, 800-642-1234. Back to our callers now with Abigail in Elm Grove. Abigail, hi.
Hi. Hi, I just wanted to ask, this summer I have been working a lot on, like, experimenting more with different types of food. For example, I started making, like, salads for breakfast. So I'd have, like, a bed of greens, and then I'd put, like, eggs on top. And
that's awesome.
I'm wondering, what can I do to really, like, push myself to grow more as a chef? I mean, it's not necessarily something I look forward to pursuing, but, as a career or something, but I just really, really, really enjoy it, and I'm just wondering how I can make it
work. I think you're well on your way. There's a lot of different cultures around the world, and not everybody starts off with, frosted flakes or eggs and bacon. There's a lot of cultures that eat rice and fish, and I love your breakfast salad idea. I may steal that. Just throw away all the things that you've been told that you have to do and start over and say, what am I in the mood to eat right now?
Is that part of the fun of being a chef, Brian, is whether we're talking breakfast or any other meal, saying, okay, how can I do a new twist or defeat expectations to try and create something new?
Just throw everything you know away. And we had breakfast for dinner last night in my house, and a lot of it was utilized, and it was kielbasa and scrambled eggs that we finished with some cheese that we had left over, and we roasted off some vegetables that were in the vegetable drawer, and man, it was delicious.
Fantastic. Well, good luck, Abigail. Keep challenging yourself. We'll go next to Don in Eau Claire. Don, hi.
Hello. I'm handicapped at the present time, but I used to be an avid mushroom forager, And one of my favorites in the past has always been sulfur shelf mushrooms. A knowledgeable friend just recently presented me with a whole bag of sulfur shelf mushrooms. It's one of the foolproof four. It's one I have no qualms about eating. And I wondered if you have any tricks up your sleeve about ways of serving them or preserving them.
Don, thanks. So sulfur shelf mushrooms, I wouldn't know how to pick those out of a lineup, Brian, but a creative way to use those.
A creative way? Well, when you say preserve, it makes me think pickle. The most important thing is obviously to get them trimmed and washed as best you can. And, you know, kind of a misconception is that you shouldn't wash or rinse off your mushrooms. That they hold moisture. It's kind of a myth. You got to get them cleaned from where they grow. I'll save you that business, but. I think pickling, you get some vinegar going with some garlic and black peppercorn, some bay leaf, fresh herbs. Throw your mushrooms in there, wrap it up, shut it off, and just let those babies pickle. And they'll last you for weeks, if not months. The other way I like to do them, if you're just ready to eat them right away, is just cook them slow in butter, keep them moving. Little salt and pepper, and you're good. I mean, those things are delicious.
Enjoy, Don. One more call. Nikki in East Troy is with us. Nikki, hi.
Hi, I was just calling to comment about the visualization with your food, something that kind of motivates me and excites me more about my food because I love cooking. I like to use colors. A lot of people sometimes use bland and they don't use enough, you know, jazz, but if you put that up with different colors like yellow or red peppers or even chives and potatoes, those things stand out on your plate and they stand out in your food, and you can
Nikki, you're right on.
Yeah, that's, and I made fun of my own presentation abilities, but that is one thing I'll do. Add, just find one more color of bell pepper, and that can make so much difference. Yeah, talk a little bit about color before we're done, Brian, and how we could play with that in our presentation.
Well, you know, I think what people may do at home without realizing it is if they have three components to their dish, whether it's a protein, a vegetable, and a starch, they accidentally end up making them all the same color, and then that becomes unexciting, unexciting food to look at. You really got to take that into consideration. And this caller sounds like she's got that figured out. You know, as far as finishing with some fresh spinach, arugula, just a really light wilt on that, a nice bright green, in my opinion, always adds a nice pop. And even if you don't want to just eat it like that, you throw it in your food processor with a little bit of Dijon and stream in some oil, and now you got this beautiful arugula pesto. There's just... it's endless. There's so much food out there, you know.
Nikki, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Brian, almost out of time in just a few seconds. What's the next seasonal ingredient you're looking forward to?
Well, all of the squashes that are coming in the season, and as I stated before, apples. Right now, I'm excited about apples. Having just attended an orchard with my kids, and the smells and those things coming into bloom. I'm excited about apples.
Brian, thanks a lot.
Sorry, go ahead.
We're out of time, Brian. Thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you.
That's Brian Frakes, executive chef at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee. He joined us for a look at the art of food presentation. We've got a couple of the recipes he shared with us today over at the Central Time Facebook page. And, hey, share a picture of some of the best, most attractive food you've made lately. It may be hard to imagine now, but in just a few months, we'll start watching for snow falling from the sky, and we'll have to shovel at least some of that snow off the ground on our sidewalks and our driveways. Well, one inventor in Ryo, Wisconsin, is looking to help us out. He's developing remote control snow removal machines. Jan Olson is working on a robo snowplow, I made that name up, and a remote controlled snowblower. He told a reporter for WhiskNews.com that he was inspired to make snow shoveling easier after surviving a heart attack while jogging, and he wanted to make snow shoveling easier, understandable. He thinks there are a lot of baby boomers who might be in need of some snow shoveling convenience. It sounds good. I used to look forward to snow shoveling as my sole form of exercise for the year. I exercise a little more now. And I've also developed a snow removal system called Two Teenage Kids. So they won't be getting a remote control snow shovel. I guess you can control this as he envisions it. You can watch it in progress from your computer or on a TV screen. So, I don't know, entertaining and practical, too. I've got a link, by the way, to an article about this Wisconsin-based snow removal drone. I don't know if it's a drone, really, on the Central Time Facebook page. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.